Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Welcome to Food Psych, a podcast dedicated to critiquing diet and wellness culture and answering your questions about intuitive eating and the anti-diet approach. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and I'm a registered dietitian, certified intuitive eating counselor, journalist, and author of the books Anti-Diet, The Wellness Trap, and the new Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook, which are all available wherever you get your books or at ChristyHarrison.com/books. That's ChristyHarrison.com/books. And by the way, on this show, we avoid diet culture details like weight and calorie numbers, but we don't censor swear words or other adult language, so listener discretion is advised. Hey there! Welcome to this episode of Food Psych, which is back for a new season. I'm Christy, and I miss the show and all of you in the year we've been off the air, so I decided to figure out a way to bring Food Psych back in kind of a limited way that fits with my new weekly podcast, Rethinking Wellness, and everything else I have going on. And that is, this season we're going to be on a monthly-ish release schedule, and I'm going to be doing a mix of interview episodes and solo Q&As. We're kicking it off this week with an interview that I'm really excited about with therapists and authors Judith Matz and Amy Pershing. They're both amazing clinicians and trailblazers in the anti-diet space, and their previous episodes of the podcast are still among our fan favorites. Judith, Amy, and I were lucky enough to get to collaborate on a book together last year, and today they joined me to talk about it. It's called The Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook, and it came out earlier this week. In the episode, we talk all about it, including how we came to work together, why the typical diet culture response to emotional eating is unhelpful and what to do instead, how to know if you're a chronic dieter as opposed to just a quote-unquote healthy eater, the role of trauma in binge eating disorder, why trauma healing doesn't necessarily lead to weight loss the way some popular cultural narratives claim, and lots more. I cannot wait to share this conversation with you, but before I do, a few quick announcements. First, of course, the new book is out now, as I just said, and you can get it by going to ChristyHarrison.com/workbook. That's ChristyHarrison.com/workbook. It's also available on Amazon and in Bookshop and other parts of the world as well, and certain retailers in Canada and the UK. But you can see all the places to get it at that link, ChristyHarrison.com/workbook. We also have some new ads on the podcast that are not read by me, so you'll hear a couple of those shortly and a few more in the middle of the episode. And look, I know these kinds of ads can be annoying, but they also help pay for the costs of making a podcast, which are quite substantial, and allow me to keep doing it. So you'll hear these new ads this season and also on some of our older episodes, and we'll do our best to make them as non-disruptive as possible. I also can't really control what ads we get, but we have blocked anything from the health and fitness or food and drink categories to avoid any overt diet culture stuff, so hopefully none of that will creep in. In any case, what I would love and be so grateful for is if you could let the ads run instead of skipping them so that we can keep the lights on over here. Speaking of which, now it's time for a word from our sponsor. Now, without any further ado, let's go to my conversation with Judith Matz and Amy Pershing. So Judith and Amy, welcome back to Food Psych. It's so great to talk with you here again. We're back together on this episode because we all co-wrote a new book together, which is the Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook. And I'm really excited to talk with you both about that today. But before we do, just for those who haven't listened to our previous episodes, I'd love to have you both share a little bit about who you are and your stories with dieting and recovery, because it's been a long time since both of those episodes. So even if people have listened, they might need a little refresher. So what's your history with disordered eating and how does it inform the work you do today?
Well, this is Judith, and I'll start. I was in high school when I started to diet for the first time. And the reason I started was because I had a fear of gaining weight. And that came from the focus on dieting by my peers. All my girlfriends were dieting, and it was also a way to become part of the group. And so I just started to restrict my eating in pretty major ways. And as the result of those restrictions, although I didn't make the connection at the time, I started binging. And that binging followed me into college. It followed me into grad school, into my first job, where I remember, for example, sitting and eating an entire Sara Lee banana cake. I mean, do you remember when Sara Lee used to be a thing? And I actually had an experience. It was after I'd left my first job and I was moving back. I live in the Chicago area now, and that's where I grew up. And I was moving back here, but I had always wanted to live on the East Coast. And so I decided to head out there for a summer. And I got a job as a server at a well-known seafood restaurant, Legal Seafood, for any of you from the East Coast. So food was plentiful there. I discovered Oreo cookie mix-ins. This is before mix-ins were a big thing. I think they kind of started out in Boston. And I was living in this tiny little studio with no scale, no mirror. And I was just tired of dieting. And I thought, just like I'm taking a summer off from my work life, I'm just going to take a summer off from dieting. And in the process of doing that, I realized at the end of the summer, my binging had stopped, that once I had actually stopped restricting myself, it just clicked for me. And I will say that for me, it was really the deprivation that fueled my eating. The dieting and the deprivation led to the binging. And so when I had that awareness, I made myself a promise that if I ever thought I couldn't eat something again because it was too fattening, I would have it to prove to myself I could. And I was fortunate in the sense that I grew up in a family where that's actually how I was fed. My mom didn't diet. Nobody in my family did. And food was fairly plentiful. We were privileged in that way. And so I was really going back to the way I ate growing up. And I wasn't someone who was using food for emotional reasons. Many of the clients I work with, there's trauma or a way that food has been a way for soothing. I'm sure we'll get into that later today. But that wasn't part of my story. And so, you know, you ask kind of what we're doing today. It actually, as I ended up, I kind of fell into a job with the OptiFast program. This was a fasting program back in the 80s, as I was doing some postgraduate work in eating disorders, getting a certificate in eating and in advanced clinical work, but I focused on eating disorders. And in working with that program, again, it didn't click with me until later when I saw people regaining the weight that it was the same story as mine. The deprivation is a major factor that leads people to feel out of control with food. And so as I saw people do that and I read my first anti-diet book back in the early 90s, again, another aha moment that made me move in that direction. And I have really loved the process of working with people who struggle with food and helping them heal their relationship with food, to be at peace with it through individual therapy. I used to do a lot of groups, through workshops, my professional trainings, and of course, writing different books, creating different resources, including this one, which I am so excited about. So that is my story and how I got to be here today.
Thank you for sharing that. Can totally see the links between what you went through personally and what you're now teaching and writing about. It's so cool to see how that has informed your work. Amy, what about you? What was your history like with disordered eating and how has that informed the work you do today?
Thanks, Christy. I love this question just because I always love hearing people's stories that, you know, our paths are so different, but our relationship with food has so many commonalities. So I had an eating disorder. I had binge eating disorder, and I didn't label it as that at the time or really understand even what that meant. But I remember hiding food and binge eating as early as 8 or 9 years old. That was also when I started dieting. I was a quote unquote chubby kid. That was the term that was used. And that was not okay to be. My mom also has had an eating disorder, disordered eating for much of her life. My grandmother did as well. And so there's a lot of legacy trauma, a lot of legacy body shame. And there are other kinds of trauma in my history as well. And so food for me was a refuge. It was a safe place. When I would binge, I wouldn't think about, I was anxious about what I was afraid about, what I was sad about, what I felt ashamed about. I would just treat myself to whatever food I wanted, typically kind of knowing I was going to have to go back on Scarsdale or Optifast or whatever it was the next day. So it was a lot of up and down and up and down and up and down with food. And I didn't realize that that was always felt like it was, I just didn't have any willpower, that really that was what was wrong, that I just couldn't stick to a diet. I was weak. And so I finally decided I didn't know what else to do. So I went into some therapy with the hopes of figuring out how I could resolve things. I didn't even know what those things were, but how I might resolve those things and then maybe be able to stick to my diet. That was really my goal. And fortunately, I had a therapist who was able to start me thinking about, you know, maybe my relationship with food was a result of some of the things that had happened to me and not a failure. And over time, as I went into graduate school, I wanted to be a therapist, I was learning and training, I was realizing that in fact, my relationship with food saved me in many, many ways. And so I'm actually grateful in many ways to my eating disorder because it allowed me to survive. And so what I've spent my career doing is really helping people learn how to heal from the things that drive that relationship with food. So that's really what I do. I started the first binge eating disorder specific treatment program in the country. When I started, binge eating disorder wasn't even a diagnosis. So we've really come a long way in terms of understanding that that relationship with food, that binging is part of an eating disorder that really requires treatment. And it requires understanding that that relationship with food is often, at least for folks with trauma histories, protective. Mm. So that's how I got here.
Thank you for sharing that. And that makes so much sense too, the lens that you come to things with and the trauma-informed way that you view binge eating. And I think all of our perspectives have complemented each other so much in writing this book. So I'm really glad we've been able to collaborate. I share my own story in the book as well, so people can check that out if they need a refresher, although I'm sure anyone listening probably is familiar with me and my story, so I won't go into it here. But I'm sure listeners are curious about how this new workbook came about, how we all came to collaborate with each other. And Judith, you were sort of the spark for that. So do you want to share a little bit about where the idea originated and how we all came to work on this together?
Yeah, I'd love to. About 5 years ago or so, I started working with PESI, which is a nonprofit organization that offers continuing education across many professions, including mental health professionals. And I contacted them because I wanted to do some training of clinicians because I didn't feel there's enough out there. People go to graduate school and they really don't learn a whole lot about how to treat binge eating disorder, about the idea of chronic dieting. And in fact, clinicians are also part of the diet culture. And so they've learned the same messages that our clients who experience this have also learned. And it's been an amazing experience to work with them. They've been so open to understanding an anti-diet philosophy, a weight-inclusive philosophy. And I started doing these trainings and have gotten just a great response, enough so that I do one almost every month. I do them virtually because it's since the pandemic, and I love being able to do it that way. And I hear back from people who have attended my trainings who were dieting themselves and have now transitioned more to an anti-diet perspective, both for themselves and they're wanting to work with their clients. And it's clear that they want a resource. They want something to help teach these ideas to their client. And so as you both know, I've worked on PESI does these card decks, and I worked, Amy, with you on the body positive card deck, and Christy with you on the making peace with food card deck. But a card deck isn't the same as a workbook, which can be so much more comprehensive. And so I wanted to do a workbook that actually just follows the outline of these trainings I give, starting from the very beginning with what diet culture is, working my way through attuned eating, through emotional eating and binge eating, looking at issues around body image, weight and health, weight stigma. And so I was envisioning it, and I talked with the editor there who was completely on board. And I do love collaborating, as you both know. I think it makes it much more fun to work with colleagues. But also, each of you has areas where you're more of an expert than I am. And so I thought, in creating what I wanted to be the most comprehensive workbook out there on these topics, because there are workbooks that deal with body image or with binge eating, but I don't think there's anything as comprehensive as what we've created. And so, Christy, you bring so much knowledge around health and nutrition and the problem with wellness culture and how to integrate that. And Amy, your work with trauma and binge eating just deepens, you know, the vision I had. And so I reached out to both of you, hoping at least one of you would be on board. And I was thrilled that both of you agreed to join me in this project. And it's been a really wonderful process to work together. Because like you said, Krista, we complement each other. We're not always exactly the same. And so that allows for a back and forth to really make sure the workbook speaks to everybody who will hopefully be using it in the most effective way.
Yeah, I really appreciate that and appreciate you bringing us both on board. And I feel like it has been such a great process to collaborate. I had been someone who I was an editor, a magazine editor many years ago, and collaborated with writers that way, and has also written for magazines and written books and had editors that I collaborated with. But I never really did a lot of writing with other people. I think I co-wrote a few pieces here and there, but nothing to the degree of the car deck we worked on or this workbook. And so it was really fun and really different to be able to dive into a collaborative process with something of this length, shape it into something that reflected all of our voices. I think that was the most interesting challenge of all this, was getting it to the point where we all felt like our voices were singing in harmony.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, in both your perspectives, who this book is for and how you each envision it being used.
I can speak to that. I'm really excited to be able to have something that, you know, for many of my clients, they're, you know, when we're working on binge eating disorder, that's the population with whom I work the most. And either they're binging or they're on a diet, one of those two, but they really have very little idea about eating intuitively, about their body's cues, about knowing their somatic experience and accepting it, what they discover. So what I'm really excited about is I think this book is a lovely journey that builds on helping clients to really hear their bodies and to come to realize, wow, I can trust my body actually much more than I can trust someone else's narratives about how to eat, and that I can trust how my body uses food and what feels right and what doesn't feel right. And how do I begin to learn those cues? So I love that about the workbook. I think it builds beautifully on that. I'm really proud and excited about that. And I think it also talks a lot about the connections between going to food, binging, and some of the emotional needs that people try to meet in that relationship with food. So I think it's also very validating. It's very empowering. It's strengths-based, by which I mean it really looks at that relationship with food as an effective, short-term anyway, coping tool. And so it's, I think, very healing for any shame that people feel, a lot of shame around these behaviors. So I feel really good about the way the workbook honors that this isn't something to be ashamed of. It's really something to look at with compassion and understanding and healing.
So I want to add to that. Obviously, that's why we all work together. Coming from that strengths-based place is so important, helping people decrease shame around binging, around body image. But the other thing that comes to mind for me is that, you know, like some people just focus on the eating relationship, but I don't think you can do that without being rooted in understanding diet culture or weight stigma or what's the research around weight and health. Because when people struggle with these issues, there are so many layers and so many components. And that's part of what I feel so proud of, is that in the workbook, I think we don't, well, I'm sure there's some stone we left unturned, but not many. We really come at it from all of those angles. And it also felt really important at the end of each chapter, we have something called Clinician's Corner, because the intention is that this workbook is for the general public, of course, and it's for clients. But clinicians also need to have some guidance on how to work with clients. And so some people, you know, Amy, you posted about this on Facebook the other day, and we got a lot of people we know, colleagues, saying, oh, I can't wait to use this. And of course, we're thrilled that will happen. But I also imagine clinicians picking this up who don't know anything about this work. And so what do they do if they're kind of starting to learn about it and they want to shift with a client? Or even I can imagine a client coming in who wants to work with a non-diet approach and the therapist not knowing how to do that. And so in these Clinician Corner pieces, we actually guide therapists or dietitians or whatever kind of clinician as to how to start thinking about it, how to use it if you're not already familiar. I even think of this one story many years ago when I was speaking one of my trainings in person. A woman came up to me. This was just so heartbreaking to me. She was a higher weight woman, a therapist, who loved this work, knew of it, but was told by her supervisor that because she was higher weight, she couldn't do this work. And so the Clinician's Corner we offer will give support to all clinicians who want to bring this to their work, to the therapeutic relationship, permission and guidance. So that feels really important to me too.
Yeah, that's so important. What a sad story. And I do hope that this book is one of the things, one of the visions that I had for it is that, like you said, it could be used for people who are outside of this anti-diet, health at every size space, or this anti-diet, weight inclusive space, who don't necessarily know much about it yet, but who are clinicians, maybe who are working through their own relationship with food and their own internalized weight stigma. Because I think that is so common. I've seen a lot of clients who've come and said, I was working with a therapist and we made so many breakthroughs on, you know, anxiety or childhood issues or trauma or whatever it might be. But then we sort of hit a wall because the clinician was recommending weight loss or they were co-signing me doing restrictive diets that ultimately I realized were not helping my recovery or whatever. I went to treatment and realized I can't be dieting anymore. And yet this therapist is still pushing me to do diets. And I think there's a real need for clinicians to just be a little more aware of all of that. And, you know, clinicians are doing their best and don't get the kind of training they need in around eating disorders and body image in school a lot of the time. So I think this will hopefully be a resource that people can use to get a good groundwork and a foundation, at least in this anti-diet work.
Exactly. There even is an inventory in there for clinicians to look at their own attitudes. You know, so there's some workbook parts for clinicians as well to explore what are my views around body size.
Yeah. So important. So this book has many components to it and a very long title to try to capture them all. Every time I say the title, I'm like, wow, yep, that captures all of it. So I'd love to go through those components one by one. So let's start with emotional eating. That's the first piece of the title. And I think something that we all have, that we're all really aligned on in terms of how we see it. Typical diet culture response to emotional eating is to say something like, don't reach for food, call a friend instead, or take a bath instead or something, right? Substituting other coping mechanisms for food. And in the process, that creates such a sense of shame around turning to food in the first place. So why is that approach unhelpful for anyone who might be sort of rooted in that approach or thinking about emotional eating in that way? And what can we do instead that might be more supportive?
What you're talking about, Christy, like when people are told, oh yeah, I get emotional eating, so don't eat, go take a bubble bath or go for a walk. That's all about control, right? And what we know when it comes to food, people can control their eating for a while, but the opposite of control is being out of control. We see people flip back and forth between being in control, being good, versus then being out of control. And what's so important is for people to be able, and Amy alluded to this earlier, to be respectful of their need to reach for food during times of distress, right? It actually works really well to soothe or calm or distract or numb. And first way we're soothed as babies is with food. And so when somebody's reaching for food to manage distress, it's actually positive that they're trying to help themselves. And so that's where I start with people, is to help, again, reduce that shame, that it's really good that you're trying to take care of yourself. And as people start to break through the diet cycle, they're in a stronger position to look at what's really bothering them. But unfortunately, what often happens is when people find themselves out of control with food, so somebody's reaching for food, and let's say it's an emotional reason, but the minute they start reaching for food, they start to yell at themselves, self-criticize. Here I go again. It's sort of what, Amy, you were talking about in your story. Like, what's the matter with me? Why can't I control this? I better do something. I better go on a diet, as if restricting food or going on a diet or eating, quote, healthier will solve the real issue, which is that you're struggling with regulating some feelings, some emotions, and losing weight or controlling food will never solve those things. So, you know, I will eventually have people say, I'm reaching for food and I'm not hungry. What am I needing to attend to? What might I think about or feel? The title of the book doesn't necessarily reflect the order I do things in, because I usually don't work intensely on the emotional issues until I've also done some work with looking at the diet cycle. And there's so much more that I could say around emotional eating. We could do a full day on that. Down the road, somebody might say, I'm reaching for food and I'm not hungry. Something's bothering me. And they might start to be in a position to say, sometimes they might need to go to the food. And we teach people to say, if you need to do it, it's okay. Sometimes that is the best way to take care of yourself. But other times a person might say, is there a different way I could soothe or calm myself? And it actually might be that bubble bath, or that walk. But the difference is it doesn't come from a place of control. I can't eat. It's I need to calm or soothe. And this is something that actually would feel good to me right now. So from the outside, it might look the same, but it comes from a very different internal place.
And I think one of the things you alluded to was like there's this bridge between those two places, the control place versus the self-care place. And that bridge to me, and I think we all agree on this, is like that we have to go through questioning diet culture, rejecting diets, learning to fully nourish ourselves so that we're not in this place of deprivation-driven eating. Because I think I see so many people who think of themselves as emotional eaters. And when we start working on the deprivation, it becomes clear that they're actually mostly deprivation-driven eaters and that they're responding to dieting and restriction instead of emotions per se. And maybe in some cases, there is still an emotional component to it as well. But getting through that layer of the deprivation-driven eating, I think can really show people what is actually there. And that's so important before going to the place of, okay, now let's look at what this eating might mean or might how I might be using it to soothe myself.
One thing too, I would just add with that is that in working with a lot of clients who are trauma survivors, one of the primary types of trauma that happen with binge eating disorders is about attachment. It's trauma in relationship with other people. And particularly, you know, early caregivers, it's most common in childhood. And often one of the biggest lessons that my clients have learned is that their feelings are unwelcome or dangerous or toxic or are in some way going to harm them or harm someone that they love. And so there's often a lot of psychological structure that says, don't feel feelings. It's dangerous to do so. And so sometimes that relationship with food, going to food, worrying about binging, worrying about dieting, worrying about weight can also be a place to put energy that would otherwise really need to go to dealing with feelings. So I often have to do a lot of work with clients just to learn more about what their schemas, what their stories are about what will happen if they do have access to their feelings. So sometimes just that step is really, really important because for many of my clients, the feeling is that, or the sense is that if they really connect to the deeper feelings, they may not survive it.
Which brings us full circle to the idea of helping our clients understand how the binging is protective.
Right. Because if you just rip away that coping mechanism and people don't have the sort of tools or resources to address feelings and to be able to feel their feelings without feeling like they're going to be totally overwhelmed, then I can see how it would just leave them feeling overwhelmed, leave them feeling adrift and without any real resources by taking away the one thing that they had of using food.
That's right. When we do trauma work, one of the things that people work on is something called their window of tolerance. And the idea within that is really learning how to tolerate our emotional experience and to deal with the impact of making that space to have feelings in a way that the clients may never have done before. So that piece becomes really important too. And this workbook, I think, helps to make those connections more accessible.
Yeah. Judith, were you going to add something there?
I mean, there's so much we could add, but I think that's the main point that we develop compassion and our clients have compassion for the parts of them that need to go to food to manage whatever has been exiled, whatever they can't tolerate. And so that weaving back and forth between the emotional or the trauma and then where chronic dieting comes in for me is the work. And it varies with each client where more of the focus is at different times along the way.
Yeah. Well, that's a good segue into talking about chronic dieting, which is the next component of our title. I think one thing that I hear from people, and I'm curious to hear your responses to, is how do I know if I'm a chronic dieter as opposed to just a quote unquote healthy eater, right? And what are the risks of chronic dieting? What are the differences between chronic dieting and is there a difference between chronic dieting and just sort of quote unquote healthy restraint, or are they one and the same?
The way I think about it has to do with the impact. So if you're somebody who says, I like to eat what are considered more healthful foods, and you eat them in a way that keeps your body nourished, and you don't have a deprivation response where you find yourself, we can call it binging or out of control or anxious around other kinds of foods, then it's not necessarily an issue. But my experience, and it makes sense for the people who come to me who call themselves healthy eaters, or I'm not dieting, I'm just eating healthy, they're in distress because they're not sustaining it over time. They are finding that if they go to a party and there's something, you know, different than what they allow themselves, and they'll even talk about it that way, what I allow myself, what I give myself permission to eat, they're in a panic, or they control it at the party and then they binge later, or they get preoccupied with food. So I think that's the easiest way to think about it is like, what is the impact on you? Is it, do you end up preoccupied thinking about food all the time? Do you feel anxious around food? Or is food a source of nourishment and pleasure, which is what we hope for, what food should be?
I agree, Judith. The thing about it is, you know, to what degree are shame and fear involved in your relationship with food?
Mm-hmm. Great way to put it.
I really like that. You know, I was one of those people who thought of myself as a quote unquote healthy eater, and then would go to a party and just be obsessed and like camped out by the food table, eating so much of the food that I wouldn't allow myself, and then feeling shame and feeling terrible and talking to people about it and making it a whole thing, not recognizing the cycle that I was in where the deprivation was driving that. And this idea of being a quote unquote healthy eater and trying to be so exemplary in my eating life the rest of the time was making me feel just completely out of control and ashamed when I ate what my body was craving and what was sort of available in the environment, and foods that I had luckily, as a growing up as an intuitive eater with the privileges I had, I wasn't ever made to feel bad about eating those foods. Those were always around and I was able to eat them without any sort of distress or any sort of feeling out of control. And it was only when I was depriving myself and was a chronic dieter really that was happening. So yeah, I think that's a good tell for people to know. One other thing, curious to hear about both of your responses too, is if you are eating in a quote unquote healthy way and you're not necessarily having those experiences of binging or shame, but it's more driven by fear, right? Like Amy said, I think that's such a good, simple heuristic of how much is shame and fear driving the boat. If you think of yourself as a healthy eater, but you have this identity around that that's so rigid that it causes you a lot of fear to think about deviating from that, or you would never allow yourself under any circumstances to deviate, that could be a problem in and of itself too, right?
Well, and that often leads to constriction socially. And in a more extreme form, it's what we call orthorexia, when everything has to be, quote, clean and perfect. And there's almost like a moral judgment about how other people eat. So that's not an official diagnosis in our DSM where we give diagnoses, but it's been described. And I think it's important, you know, to recognize. The other thing I want to say to add to what you're talking about is that none of us are against eating healthful foods, right? But it's interesting when that becomes an identity in and of itself versus just, you know, a preference or something that feels supportive and nourishing to my body. And one of the things I love that we do in the workbook is in a later chapter, we do talk about some nutrition and some ways to think about food that allows to make choices that support your body without getting stuck in what you're talking about, it coming from a place of fear and shame. And we were intentional about putting that very late in the book. And this is also true when I work with clients, because when people who say I'm a healthy eater, but the issue really is it's code for, I don't want to gain weight. At that point, when people hear nutrition information or anything about thinking about how foods impact their body, it just gets used as like diet or wellness information that's not ultimately helpful. So there's room in our anti-diet approach to think about foods and how they affect your body, but it's actually a very later stage in healing a relationship with food.
One thing I find too sometimes for people that I work with is the sense of if there's a redemption in, you know, we use such moralizing terms around food. I'm being good. I'm cheating, right? I think sometimes for my clients, comes even further, like you were saying, it's an identity kind of thing. There's a redemption, you know, for all of the things that I don't like about me that are not okay about who I am, or that I feel shame about, or, you know, I've felt judged about or rejected about. If I'm eating quote unquote cleanly, there's a redemption there. You know, this is something about me that's pure and good and right, that I can feel good about. And so what I find is as people are working through that, there's a real loss there actually in shifting that relationship with food. You know, there isn't this kind of easy way to make all the scary things go away. So there's actually a loss there in some ways of food just being food.
That's really important what you're talking about. But as you were talking, Amy, I also thought about with it being redemptive, there is so much support for that in our culture. They get admired and complimented.
That's how it works. Absolutely. Yeah.
And then that just reinforces the identity. That just reinforces the sense that you have to do it more in order to be worthy and accepted and loved and get all the things that you want, because that's the feedback you're getting, right, from the world around you, is that this is good, keep it up.
And of course, it reinforces other typically trauma-led narratives. Like, there's, if you're a certain way, you're acceptable. If you're another way, you're not. And so those stories are particularly seductive to people who already have those beliefs about themselves. Mm,
such a good point. Collaborating with you both was so fun. And I think we see eye to eye on so many things and have kind of a basic shared philosophy. But there were also a few areas where we had different perspectives and had to find a way to bridge those. And I think this was especially true when it came to binge eating and the reasons people binge, because Judith and I tend to see a lot of clients for whom restriction and dieting drives binging, maybe because of our stories and sort of what we put out there in the world. And Amy, you see more people for whom trauma is at the root of the binge eating. So could you talk about the role trauma plays and what might need to be different in the approach to binge eating when it's driven by trauma?
Sure. I always think it's just of some use to kind of define the word trauma, because I think, you know, kind of in popular parlance, we tend to kind of think about a trauma as like a single incident trauma, a death or the loss of property, or, you know, you're impacted by a war, or, you know, something like that. But more what's true for clients who are dealing with binge eating disorder is that typically they're struggling with something we refer to as complex trauma. And that's typically happens in childhood. And it's trauma that happens typically in relationship. So basically, the people who we should most be able to trust to keep us safe, who we should most be able to be authentic and truly ourselves around, in fact, become sources of danger. So it might be that a parent, for example, is emotionally or physically or even sexually abusive, or maybe struggles with substance use disorder, or is absent a great deal, or just has their own emotional struggles and is unable to really witness the child. And so what tends to happen is that children develop beliefs about, you know, what is acceptable about them and what is not. It's not possible to really be just themselves in relationship. They learn that they have to work in order to be in relationship with love is conditional, is the bottom line. And so ultimately what tends to happen is parts of who they truly are have to be hidden or diminished or negated or shamed, so that they're more what they need to be in order to survive that system, whatever it might be. And so one thing a child may, if it's available to them, have access to pretty early is food. And food can become, as Judith said earlier, it was a great point, one of the first ways we're soothed is with food. And so what I find for many of my clients who deal with complex trauma is that relationship with food started very early. I wrote a book with another colleague of mine about binge eating disorder. And one of the things that she talks about in that book is hiding food in her room when she was 8, knowing that she would have something to go back to, that it was there for her. So that when she got through her father coming home drunk and, you know, getting into a fight with her mother and, you know, all kinds of different things that happened, she knew that she had those cookies hidden in the floorboards of her room. And so that allowed her to hold down her shame and her fear and her rage and just try to make her parents get along. And then she could come back to her room and soothe herself. And so that's a big piece of how food gets woven in with trauma. It becomes a way that kids can soothe the parts of themselves that are not okay to be shown in their relationships. So they learn that only certain parts of me are okay. And so over time, they develop what we call schemas, or just ideas, fundamental ideas about their worth and value. And so in order to go out in the world and be in relationship, I can only show part of who I am. And so food becomes a way to soothe all of the things, or distract from or diminish all of the things that are not acceptable in the world. And so that's why I say, given the resources that children have, binging is a pretty brilliant strategy, actually, to survive those systems.
Mm. That's so powerful and so heartbreaking to hear it put like that. It's beautifully said.
And in fact, as I want to say, it's not just when Christy, when you talk about us coming at it from different ways, I've always thought of it as just two streams, right? There's the deprivation and there's the emotional, which for me goes into complex trauma or other traumas. And I remember one client I worked with where even as an adult, the trauma she was still experiencing was to such a great degree that when she was talking about wanting to end some of the binging, I was like, I just wanted her to have compassion for the reason she needed to go to food. I didn't actually think she was ready to let go of that. So sometimes I do work with clients with trauma where that is front and center. I think what you're referring to is coming from a different place is that I have also had clients where once we end the deprivation, yep, they're off and running, that there wasn't this kind of a history. And so the proportion, I don't know what it is. You know, when people come with binging, they still meet the category of binge eating disorder, even though the deprivation was the bigger factor. But for the majority of clients I work with, I would say also there is this emotional, often trauma piece. It made me think about one client I had where looking back, I worked too quickly on the deprivation-driven eating because she wasn't ready to give it up. She still needed it. And it was going too well for her. And she wasn't ready to manage the intensity of emotions that came up. And she left. I rarely have had this happen, but she did leave therapy very abruptly. And as I reflected on what happened, I'm pretty sure that's what it was. It was just too fast.
I definitely can relate to that too. I think, especially as a dietitian, there's not always the resources there to help people deal with trauma. And I refer out and want people to work with clinicians who can help support them in that. But I think sometimes people have this understandable desire to let go of a coping mechanism they feel like isn't serving them anymore. And I think it takes a clear eye and sort of an understanding of trauma to really be able to see and slow that down. And I think for me as a dietitian, I think maybe many dietitians in the audience can relate to this. I'm like, yes, let's do this. Let's find you. Let's give up the deprivation and like not have that driving you toward food in the same way. But then people do often find when that happens, when they aren't feeling so driven by deprivation and food loses its luster. Judith, you say it's glitter, right? I think sometimes that can be really sad for people and a really difficult part of the process when food loses that magic that it once had. And then you have to find other things that are going to give you that or other ways to self-soothe because you're not feeling like using food anymore.
One thing that I find is really powerful for clients is that to know that when they, for clients who have trauma histories and for whom that relationship with food goes way back, it was the one thing that they had available. It wasn't the thing that they needed. And so a lot of recovery is really about making space now, at last, finally, to get not just what's available, but what's needed. You know, food is a mask of need. It doesn't really meet them ultimately. It can in the moment, but ultimately it wreaks a lot of havoc to have a binge eating disorder. So really, I think a lot of what we're doing is something that one clinician in our field refers to as hope merchanting. You know, we're really helping our clients to see that, wow, there's a whole lot of really good stuff to come. And food may remain in that toolbox. It may remain in there for a long time. But the process of healing is additive. It's not subtractive.
Yeah, that's so helpful. Body image is the last part of the title. And that's something that I know many clinicians struggle to help clients with. I've heard many people, you know, clinicians say, and even clients say that they feel like body image is just a can that keeps getting kicked down the road. You know, we'll deal with it later. We'll address that later. I'm curious what your approaches to working with body image are and why.
Well, for me, it's integrated from the beginning. Again, you know, every client is unique. And so the way I show up for clients depends on what their needs are. So I don't see it as kicking the can down to later. And at the same time, I will often say to clients, it can be the harder part of the work. Because truthfully, I find that when people begin to have some attuned eating experiences where they're identifying some hunger and they're eating something that truly satisfies them, it feels so good. And they start to collect these experiences and they start to feel hopeful. But body image is so difficult because I think Chris used the word earlier, worthiness. Like, we'll get messages so early in life that their worthiness is based on how they appear. And of course, all the cultural messages. So I bring it in different ways at different times. But when we use the word body image in the workbook, it's kind of a cover word for so many things. I mean, we're really talking about helping people feel more at home in their bodies. And in order to do that, it may mean looking at their internalized weight stigma, like when did you first start to get these messages and who did they come from? and what was their intention? So looking at marketing messages of, you know, companies trying to sell products versus a parent who was higher weight themselves and felt shamed and is trying to protect you from that shame. It really matters. Like, where did these messages come from? What was the intention of the person giving them to you? But then woven into that is all the messages around weight and health that, you know, if you're higher weight, you're going to get sick and get all these illnesses. And so again, that's what I think is so important about what we do in the workbook, because I don't know that there are other workbooks that integrate really looking at some of the research about weight and health. And often I'm giving that to my clients very early on when they're terrified. Like, if I quit dieting and don't lose weight, am I going to get sick and die sooner? An understandable fear given the messages out there. And so very early on, I might share some of the research with, you know, did you know? I was sharing that with a client today who's starting to talk about her fear of, she was undernourishing her body. And as she's finally nourishing her body, she's gained some weight. And part of her knows this is better for her and she's ending the preoccupation. But part of her is terrified because in her family, the value has been, in order to be healthy, you have to be very thin and very fit. And so I shared some research about that looks at just using the, I hate to use the BMI categories, but that's how the research is done. And it looks at people who are in the so-called overweight category at a population level actually live the longest. And when I say to people or at my trainings, did you know that? They're really surprised. They had no idea. That doesn't make the front pages, even though there's over 40 studies confirming that.
Yeah. And one of the things I do along those same lines, Judith, in terms of sharing that information with clients, I agree. I think that's such a powerful thing to do. It also dovetails, you're sharing the truth, which is not easily found. That is so often the journey of recovery from trauma, is recovering the truth and looking at all the different ways that we had to compromise the truth in order to be part of the system. And so what I find is when we can draw that parallel with clients around body image, right? Basically teaching you to feel that your body's not acceptable and, you know, who benefits? It's a $4 billion industry. You know, a lot of people benefit and you continuing to buy into the narratives about what's wrong with you. And so it's really the same work as healing from any other trauma, right? Is that your body is not a project to fix. It's your home. The narrative that it's something to fix is, you know, there's investment there, just like there may be investment in a family system in keeping secrets. So a lot of recovery is in speaking truth. What I find is that when clients learn more and more about this stuff, they get mad. And I find that to be a really powerful, powerful way of saying, wait a minute, it builds resiliency against those messages in a way that I don't really think anything else can. It's really a way of saying, I'm not going to be taken advantage of anymore, even if it means I might not be on the same wavelength as many of the people currently in my life. I might be bleeding edge around this. I might have to find my own community and really work to do that, but I'm going to do that.
Yeah. And that anger also, not only in the way you're describing it, but within the medical community, because so many of our clients being told by their doctors that they have to lose weight, even though there's no research to show weight loss can be sustained and maintained. And we actually know that weight cycling is bad for your health. And so I'm finding that some of my clients getting mad at the medical community is helping them find health professionals who will actually listen to them and treat them more holistically without that weight loss focus.
Yeah, so important. Okay, so we've covered our title, which is very long. We also have a longish subtitle, which is A Trauma-Informed, Weight-Inclusive Approach to Make Peace with Food and Reduce Body Shame. I won't break down every aspect of that because we're almost at time, but I do want to talk about what trauma-informed means in this context and why is it important for books about disordered eating to be trauma-informed, as well as this piece that we've talked about offline, all of us before, about, you know, this idea that trauma, that higher weight people necessarily carry trauma and that's why they're higher weight. So just curious to hear any thoughts you have on that.
Yeah, because that's such a pervasive sort of idea that all bodies, when they're at their healthiest, when they're the way they should be, would be a thin body. And that's sort of the narrative. So if you've resolved your trauma, that means that you'll be in a thin body. And the converse, if you're not in a thin body, you haven't resolved your trauma. And of course, what's true is bodies come in all shapes and sizes and can be healthy in all shapes and sizes. So fundamentally, we can't tell where someone is in their work with their own trauma by looking at their body. We don't know. So that's the first thing. The second thing is if we're setting up this narrative that weight loss, again, is a treatment goal, that's weight stigma. right? That is diet culture. We're setting up the story that your body is somehow something to fix, and that once you've worked through your quote unquote issues, your body will be an acceptable shape and size. And of course, I think what trauma-informed treatment in part means is that we really are seeing that that is not the way to approach this, that really what we're helping clients to do is to be in integrity with the body that they're in. And I always try to say to, you know, clients at various points along the way, your body's not a billboard, it's your home, right? And so suppose your home isn't something to fix, but your home is something to have compassion for, to speak its stories about what it's been through, and to do things that honor it, that take the very best care of it. What might that look like? So I think that's a piece of being trauma-informed.
And I had written an article for the Psychotherapy Networker called Unlearning Weight Stigma that I was really directing toward the trauma field. Because like you're saying, Amy, there's this belief, first of all, if somebody's higher weight, they must have had trauma. And the reality is people of all sizes have had trauma and people of all sizes haven't. But when you have somebody who, you know, has used food and gained weight as a result to manage what we, you know, all the stuff we talked about earlier to manage trauma, then what they're advised to do is to lose weight. And one of the things we know is that physiologically, when people try to lose weight over time, they get heavier, they gain more weight. And it's not that there's anything wrong with being at a higher weight, but the very thing people are told to do guarantees, right, over time that they're going to keep gaining weight. We know that's the result of the yo-yo cycle. And so people are almost under this cloud of shame with people assuming that they're facing trauma. And sometimes that phrase I hear is that, like, if they solve their trauma, their body will just let go of the weight.
Release the weight. I hear that too.
Release, right. And so ironically, people who are very compassionate, deep thinkers in the therapy field are still promoting weight-based trauma. I hope that will shift over time.
I hope so too. And I think work like both of yours is helpful in that, and just sort of generally getting messages out about weight stigma and the problems that it creates, I hope will help reduce that narrative, though it is still pervasive, unfortunately. Let's talk a little bit about body shame, which plays a role in so many of these problems that we are talking about. Amy, you focus a lot on shame in your work. So can you define shame and talk a bit about how body shame affects people?
Sure. One of the ways I think about shame, which I think is maybe a little bit different than kind of we commonly think about it. So, you know, we think about a lot of clinical interventions are, let's get rid of shame. Let's, you know, let's diminish it. Let's not feel shame. Shame is a bad thing to feel. And I sort of look at it a little bit differently. I think shame is protective, actually. It's not a truth teller. Its job is not to speak truth. Its job is ultimately to get us to diminish the things or minimize or stuff down the things about us that are not acceptable in a particular group or situation. So it is at its core a way that we make ourselves what we believe to be more lovable. And of course, weight stigma and, you know, the thin, you know, diet culture fits into that paradigm perfectly, unfortunately, because it really sets up this story that you should have a different body. And if it doesn't look a certain way, and if it doesn't, you should feel shame about that. And so we're taught from the earliest of times to feel shame about our bodies and to feel like the only resolution to that shame is to make our bodies fit into whatever the mold might be. So what I find, again, is a lot of that is really working with helping clients to see how shame-based stories, I'm not good enough, whether it's my body or anything else about me, that's not what the truth is. It's how we survived. It's how we made ourselves smaller. And, you know, I think it's sort of interesting that particularly for women and increasing numbers of men too, but particularly for women, you know, if we think about fundamentally, dieting is about making us small. I don't think that's an accident. Right? At the core, it's about making us as small as we can be. I think if we think about that metaphorically, there's a lot of ways that we're told to keep ourselves small. And shame grows exponentially when those narratives are allowed to survive.
So well said.
You're focusing on the subtitle, and the subtitle is Reducing Body Shame, which Amy has described so well. I want to point out that it's reducing and not ending. From my perspective, the reason is because our culture is so toxic around this. And then I see people feeling shame about feeling bad about their bodies. So the goal is not that you read our workbook and you never feel body shame again, that you have to feel good about your body 24/7. That's just unrealistic. What's much more realistic is that when thoughts come up related to body shame, that you now have different skills and strategies to notice that part and work with it as opposed to it taking over. I think that the idea of reducing is important. I know people have a lot of reaction to the word body positivity, that idea that you're supposed to feel good about your body all the time. And that's not what we're after with the workbook. But again, it's developing skills coming from that strength-based place, that when you experience a reach for food or a negative feeling about your body, that you now have ways to talk with yourself about it that leave you feeling empowered.
Yeah, I think that's so well said. That's such an important point. Is there anything else you want to share about this book or the process of writing it?
Judith, this isn't particularly, but one thing I would just add, going back just for a second, Christy, about the shame piece and our goal is to reduce it. I love that idea, Judith, too, about meeting the parts that hold shame with compassion and with gentleness. And also with keeping in mind that, you know, just that story that somehow if we do this well, we're going to end up in a space where we're going to feel good about our bodies all the time. Just even the idea that that's the end goal. We're going to be happy about how it looks as opposed to increasingly living in it. I think it's just sort of an interesting kind of setup that really the goal, it seems to me, to set a goal or to even think about, I wish I could feel good about my body all the time, still sets that as the most important thing.
Versus I'm going to do my best to stay connected to my body, notice what it needs, and do my best to meet its needs.
That's right. Also, you know, I was just talking with somebody today about, she was saying, you know, if I feel good about my body, what about, so do I not wear makeup? Do I, you know, like what is, you know, what's the implication there? And I had to pause because I really love makeup. So I had to think about this for a second. And what I thought about is it's playful. It's fun. It's delightful. I think where it becomes funky is if you feel like you can't leave the house without it.
And it's just, Amy, I'm the exact opposite. Like, I don't want to spend any time doing makeup. And so I don't, unless I'm going to like a special event where I want to look a little different than usual. But I think that's so important. That's what's caretaking for you is not caretaking for me. And that's, again, the wonderful outcome of this work is everybody gets to figure out how to stay connected to themselves and do what's best for them.
Right. And I think about it too, is like, imagine if it was just about delight. It was just about having fun with it. If you feel like it, grand. If you don't, that's fine too.
Yeah, so important. I've been thinking about that a lot lately with my daughter because she's 2 now and she's very perceptive and picks up on everything. And I've put on makeup around her before and she's like, Mama's lipstick, Mama makeup. And she knows what it is, or, you know, she's starting to know what it is. But I'm like, I don't really want her to ask me questions about this and I don't have good answers because for me, it's not super playful or fun or expressive either. It's more of a mask I put on to like look a certain way to get me access to certain things. You know, I know that in certain situations, I'm going to look more quote unquote put together by society standards if I wear makeup. And so I do. Most of the time, I just don't wear it or I wear like a tinted moisturizer because I have a lot of acne scars and have some shame about that. But I don't wear makeup much around her other than that. And it's made me have more of a sort of dialogue with myself and investigation about why I do it. And I've come to the place of like, well, you know, this is a ticket in the door for some things in our society. You know, it's not something I actually really like, although it can be pleasurable sometimes, but like very rarely for me. But it's more just like I'm doing it as the price of admission to like getting access to spaces. If I'm going to be speaking or be on TV or something or go to an event where people are going to be scrutinizing me, I could be radical and not wear makeup and have that be sort of a point of conversation. Or I could get my message, other messages across that I want to get across maybe, or like blend in a certain way that might be useful if I wear makeup. And so I think of it that way, which is kind of looking at it as like a systems-based thing.
Right. And feeling like we can push back when we feel like it, not when we don't. Like we do live in the system and we can figure out how to navigate it and where we're willing to compromise. And
right, totally. Because we can't be uncompromising on everything all the time. I mean, some people can probably, but to me, that seems very exhausting and a recipe for not really getting a lot done in life that I might want to get done. Well, is there anything else you want to share about this book or the process of writing it?
I just want to put out there a thank you to Passy for being so supportive of our work and our editor, Kate, who's been amazing. They've done a beautiful job of editing and setting it up and making it really accessible to people. You can copy pages and there's plenty of room to write in it. And so I just hope it will be a really helpful resource for both people in general and for clinicians who are invested in healing relationships with food and body.
And I feel really good about how much of it is woven with just permission and invitation and space to be curious instead of it feeling directive or prescriptive or formulaic. I think there's room for people to find their own voice.
Yeah, I feel like that's something that we focused a lot on in our collaboration that was so lovely, where we would look at the language and think, oh, does that feel too prescriptive? What about making this more of a question or an invitation, and made the language so much more compassionate, I think, through that iterative process. Well, thank you both so much for being here. It's a pleasure talking with you and a pleasure working with you. And I'm so psyched for people to find this book and learn more about it. Is there anywhere I'll share my link to the book on my website, and you can also get it on Amazon and some other major retailers. But if you go to christyharrison.com/workbook, you'll see a bunch of the places to get it. Is there anywhere that you both want to direct people to or anything else you want to promote?
I will have a link as well on my website, judithmatz.com. I also send out a quarterly newsletter that just gives updates around topics related to attuned eating, weight and health. It always has a vignette of somebody working with some aspect of this. And I guess I'll just mention that one of my books, Beyond a Shadow of a Diet, which is primarily for clinicians, I have a third edition coming out in May. So you don't have to be a clinician to read it, but if you want more examples of how people, as a therapist or as a dietitian, how to help people work their way through this, look for that in May as well.
And for mine, you can just find me or the workbook, if you have any questions for me, at thebodywiseprogram.com. And there's also a link to my book called Binge Eating Disorder, The Journey to Recovery and Beyond, on the website as well.
Thank you. Thank you both so much for being here. Pleasure as always to talk with you. And yeah, take care.
Thanks, Christy. Thank you.
So that's our show. Thanks again to our guests for being here. And thanks to you for listening. If you found this podcast helpful, I'd be so grateful if you take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can see all the places to subscribe at christyharrison.com/subscribe. That's christyharrison.com/subscribe. If you're looking for help healing your own relationship with food, grab my free audio guide, 7 Simple Strategies for Finding Peace and Freedom with Food. Just go to christyharrison.com/strategies to get it. That's christyharrison.com/strategies. To get full show notes and a transcript of this episode, go to christyharrison.com/foodpsych. And to get the transcript, find the episode page and scroll down to the bottom to enter your email address. A big thanks to Softer Sounds for audio editing and production, and to administrative assistant Julianne Witasek for helping me out with all the moving parts that go into producing this show. Our album art was photographed by Abby Moore Photography, and the logo was designed by Melissa Alam. Our theme song was written and performed by Carolyn Pennypacker Riggs, and I'm your host and executive producer, Christy Harrison. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, stay psyched.